From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. This week we have a new doc for the housebound. In 1971, when sound designer Jim Lebrecht was 15, he had a summer of love kind of experience at a camp for disabled kids, a place that fostered a spirit of history-changing activism. He shared his memories with his friend, filmmaker Nicole Noonan, and they agreed this could make a good movie. They didn't anticipate that some VIP backers would think so, too.
What a sentence to be able to say. We knew we could partner with the Obamas, Barack and Michelle.
It does still sound pretty amazing, you know, every time we say it.
Co-directors Noonan and Lebrecht, who was born with spina bifida and uses a wheelchair, tell us about making their new documentary, Crip Camp, which won this year's Audience Award at Sundance and will be streaming on Netflix in a few days. But first, despite everything, we banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my at-home buddy and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there. Just to be clear, we are at our own homes, not at the same home.
Yes. We are not at the same home. We are both home, though, as is most of the KCRW staff and many, many people. We want to say, for starters, how devastating and how much of our hearts are going out to everybody. And of course, this is a show is The Business. Many, many people in the business are really suffering right now. And we are just going to have our thoughts with them and hope that things improve and turn around. This is a very tough time. For those people who are affected in this business, of course, the fate and health of the business and the potential that the business can recover is a key consideration. So we should talk about that. You know, a lot of TV shows, I mean, everything is essentially shut down. Writers are still writing. They can do that through a virtual means. But when these things can get back into production, what that means for TV schedules, for every network, for streamers, for viewing habits, all of this is a wide open question right now.
Yeah, what we're seeing is about 60 broadcast pilots are shut down. These are shows that were planned for consideration for fall. We're in the early stages of being produced and now will not be produced for the time being. We're seeing a bunch of shows that were already in production, existing shows, shut down in the middle or before they started. So we're seeing things like Fargo season 4 be pushed from its April premiere date because it was unable to be finished. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. For the broadcast television industry, the fall season is what's the key here, because that's where all the advertising commitments are being made. And if these shows don't get up and running by May or June, we're going to start to see the fall season be pushed. And I've already heard people saying that the January may be the new fall season. And if that's true, then that's going to throw a giant wrench into the entire TV ad ecosystem. Because as much as we talk about streaming and all the new options out there, the television broadcast industry is still a $10 billion industry. And that's going to be severely impacted if there are no new shows.
Yeah, I mean, right now, of course, we already see the broadcast audience go up as people are home, and we're seeing ratings go up on shows, I think, that are, you know, people are just turning to television. One of the questions that people ask over and over I see on social media is, why aren't the studios releasing movies pay-per-view, and people would pay this much or that much for a movie? But we've done an analysis of this and talked to a lot of people about it. This is a strategy of desperation, really. This is a strategy, I mean, Universal has done it with several films. They did it with Invisible Man, The Hunt, and Emma. And Sony has done it with Bloodshot, the Vin Diesel movie, all of which had brief, greater or lesser moments in the theater as the crisis was escalating and, you know, the grosses were whatever they were. None of those is a huge movie. The one that has not been in theaters at all, that Universal is going to try it as a pay-per-view experiment, is the latest Trolls film, the next installment. But contrary to what people think, this is not some no-brainer where they would just be able to recoup their money, especially on a big budget film. Trolls is a pretty big budget film, probably 90-100 million. You did not see this with Minions, which Universal also has. They pushed that. You didn't see it with Fast 9, the next Fast and Furious movie. Those movies are very, very big budget movies. And even with a smaller movie, it is unclear how many families, especially with difficult economic times coming, how many families are going to shell out $20 to watch something for, you have an availability of maybe 48 hours, you know, if you have other options like streaming, it's not so clear that they can really sell enough copies of a movie like Trolls to even recoup their investment. You know, for Trolls, they've already committed not only the budget I mentioned, but tens of millions in advertising that they cannot recoup, even though the movie wasn't supposed to open for another few weeks. So this is not an easy solution for the studios. Contrary to what so many people out there seem to think, they seem to think they would make all this money, but that is not what we're hearing.
Yeah, there's two issues here. I mean, the cost you mentioned, $20 for a movie, I mean, that's more than two times the entire monthly subscription for Disney Plus, where there are hundreds of movies available. And secondly, this notion of these movies, oh, just drop them on a streaming service, just make them pay-per-view. You know, Minions made $1 billion, the last one. Fast and Furious, that's a $1.5 billion grosser, the last one. The economics of these movies are such that they are greenlit with a certain amount of box office in mind. And, you know, that's needed for these movies. And we're now all of a sudden in a situation that the movie industry has never been in before. The entire distribution platform for theatrical movies is gone. It's not happening. And this has never happened in the history of the movie business, where we're having a weekend without box office. There's no such thing as box office in America. So they've got to do something. And you either have these two options. You push, which is what they're doing with the big budget movies, or you find a pay-per-view or some kind of digital solution, which is what we're seeing with the lower budgets.
Yeah, the theaters are asking for help, for a bailout. They have said repeatedly, the National Association of Theater Owners, that they are going to come back and movies, people love movies, and they're going to go, and it's going to, you know, eventually be okay. But in the meantime, it's not okay, and they are asking the federal government for help. And Tom Rothman, the chairman of Sony Pictures, when he said they were going to put Bloodshot as a on-demand offering, he emphasized, we are not changing our strategy. This is an emergency. We're doing this one-off. We are support windowing. We support theaters. We will be back in theaters when this is over. Now, Tom Rothman and Sony don't have a streaming service where they could play around with windowing. Universal, which did put its movies in an on-demand offering, and Warner's have both wanted to change windowing. And this may be an opportunity for them to sort of, you know, say, well, viewing habits are changing, and they're not going to want to do it in the middle of a crisis, but viewing habits may change, and it may give them a window, so to speak, to change the windows.
Yeah, it's no coincidence that Universal is being so aggressive with the pay-per-view stuff, because they're owned by Comcast, and Comcast is a big vehicle through which people utilize pay-per-view services. You know, Comcast is also launching Peacock, a streaming service that is going to try to compete with some of the ad-driven streaming services that are out there. And, you know, with the Olympics in jeopardy and a lot of these other things that NBC, Comcast owns, they would like to drive people to that service. And maybe some of these movies that are brand name movies, putting them on the streaming service would make sense to try to make a splash and lure people in there. I don't think they'll do it with a movie like we discussed before, like Minions or like Fast and Furious, just because of the economics we discussed. But for some of these mid-range movies, streaming might make sense. Warner's is the same. Warner Brothers is now owned by AT&T, which is launching HBO Max, a subscription Netflix-like service that is going to try to bring a bunch more subscribers into that streaming universe. And they would love to put some of these big budget or bigger budget lures for people to say, hey, you know, that movie that I wanted to see in theater, I couldn't see it there. Maybe I'll check it out on HBO Max because it's there 3 months earlier than it would be on regular HBO.
Many people have said, can the streamers that are coming on, notably Peacock and HBO Max, can they hurry up? What I am hearing suggests that not only can they not hurry up, but they are going to have trouble. They are not sure they can make their target dates, which are in the next few weeks, because of technological issues. So they would love to hurry up. But, you know, you see things happening where the events, such as you mentioned, Peacock with the Olympics and HBO Max with the Friends reunion, for example, that's been delayed. These are things that either are not happening or will not happen. So, yeah, the challenges abound for the companies and for the people who depend on the companies for their living. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Under my feet, I feel the sky coming. Jim Lebrecht is co-director of the new Netflix documentary, Crip Camp, A Disability Revolution. And he's also one of the film's subjects.
I wanted to be part of the world, but I didn't see anyone like me in it.
I hear about a summer camp for the handicapped run by hippies. Somebody said you probably all smoke dope with the counselors, and I'm like, sign me up.
Going to Camp Jeannette in upstate New York in the early 1970s changed the then 15-year-old Lebrecht's life, and he wasn't the only one. Crip Camp offers a trove of archival footage showing something that was rare for disabled teenagers. The freedom just to be kids.
Come to Camp Jeannette and find yourself.
The spirit of Camp Jeannette would be a spark that later lit a fire of disability activism as a group of former campers found themselves living as young adults in and around Berkeley. It was there that former Jeannette camper and counselor Judy Heumann fought for the very first federal protections for people with disabilities. And she led a 1977 sit-in at the San Francisco office of the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare.
A small army of the handicapped have occupied this building for the past 11 days.
The occupation would last 28 days as Heumann boldly faced off against members of the Carter administration who had been sent to quell the rebellion.
We will no longer allow the government to oppress disabled individuals. And I would appreciate it if you would stop shaking your head in agreement when I don't think you understand what we are talking about.
Former camper Jim Lebrecht co-directed Crip Camp with his friend Nicole Newnham, an Emmy-winning documentary filmmaker. Before everything changed, we were expecting to talk with Lebrecht and Newnham in person at KCRW. Instead, we spoke to them from a studio in Oakland before the Bay Area instituted strict shelter-at-home rules. Even then, it was clear that the film's rollout would be disrupted.
We had a number of trips planned that had been canceled, including going over to Europe for the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, and we're dealing with this day by day, and it's better to be safe than sorry.
And Nicole, did Netflix say don't fly, or did you guys say we're not flying because it's a bad idea right now?
Actually, Netflix recommended that we not fly, and the same with Higher Ground. I think everybody's just trying to be really cautious, you know, and it's tough, but we are glad that the film will be out there for people to watch at home, even if, you know, they can't congregate in theaters to see it. But we just came back from True False in Missouri and had some really spectacular screenings for, you know, sort of 1,700 person theaters. And we had this amazing set of screenings at Sundance. So we feel lucky compared to so many people who are really, really suffering, who are trying to get films out in the world right now.
True. Netflix is probably, I don't know how many options you had or considered, but well, tell me how many options you had and considered.
Well, we had several options, and we were really attracted to the idea of Netflix because of the broad global reach of it, of the platform. For us, the idea that the film could be, you know, accessible and reach people all over the world with this story, which is such an important story that we really feel passionately about people coming to know, was really exciting. And then when, you know, Higher Ground became interested as well, and we knew we could partner with the Obamas and their company, then that became, you know, a really, really exciting option.
What a sentence to be able to say. We knew we could partner with the Obamas, Barack and Michelle.
It does still sound pretty amazing, you know, every time we say it to us too.
So let's just step back a bit to the beginning. I have to say, Jim, the footage view as a little boy, as a little boy, is the most adorable thing I've seen. What an amazing kid you were.
Well, that's really nice of you to say. I think, first off, I'm amazed that my dad shot all of this stuff and that we were actually able to kind of use it for the film. And I don't know, my Aunt Jeanette always kind of told me that she thought there was something about me that was just amazing, that I just could figure things out and wasn't going to let anything stop me. And you can kind of see it in those home movies.
Yes, you see this adorable child who has spina bifida, as you did, and you are figuring out how to do one thing after another with this huge smile on your face. You then, I don't know, I'm not sure whether you were brought up in an environment, you know, this is a conversation that is big among the campers at the camp, and, you know, how protective are the parents, and what do the parents let you do, or what are they scared to let you do? I don't know how your experience was growing up.
Well, I don't think my parents were not overprotective. they definitely kept an eye out for me. But I think that it was kind of a partnership that I was showing them that I was fairly capable of stuff and wasn't liable to get myself into trouble. And that they had a good sense that for me to succeed, I had to be out in the real world. So I don't recall anything like how some of the other campers talk about in the film about their parents not wanting them to do something because they were afraid that I would be disappointed. Fortunately, that was just not part of my life and my upbringing.
Yes. So you get to go to this camp, this camp where it all happens. It's all going on at the camp. And even if you have never been to this particular kind of camp, it's anybody who lived in that era, it's like a nostalgia fest watching a bunch of basically hippie kids being young hippies.
Yeah, you don't really see folks with disabilities really being represented in this way. We were just, a bunch of kids in this incredible time in history, just being kids and really exploring what life could be all about.
So someone comes to, I get the impression, and I was doing, some reading, some kind of hippie filmmakers come and basically attach a camera to what, to a, I'm not, how did that work? So that you were shooting footage yourself?
I mean, yeah, you could see in the footage, they all have very long hair and beards. And I think they were definitely part of the culture there. And I was drawn to anything that was audio or video or anything. And while they were there one day, they said, let's just strap the tape deck to the back of your handlebars in your chair and give you the camera and we'll just push you around camp and let's do a camp tour.
They were called the People's Video Theater, and they were an early radical video coalition that were in a station wagon when they stopped at a gas station and met a van full of hippie kids from Camp Jened with disabilities and hippie counselors. And the Jenedian folks said, hey, man, what is that equipment? You should come over and film the Camp Olympics tomorrow. And so they got there, and the camp was shut down, and they couldn't get in, so they dropped some acid and, hung out for a couple of hours. And then eventually the gates of the camp opened, and they walked in, and that was the middle of the crabs epidemic.
What, you want me to tell them what happened? Well, two people got crabs, and they're spreading.
We were all very hyper about it, and I have to go shower some people.
I said it was all going on at the camp.
Yeah. So they just turned on their cameras and started filming, and they stayed for several days, and it was kind of a miracle that 50 years later, Jim and I decided to try to make a film about the camp, and we were able to track down two of the founders of the People's Video Theater, and Howard Gutstadt and Ben Levine, and they lived in the Bay Area just a couple of miles from us, and were midway through transferring all the footage when we contacted them. It was just incredible.
So they were digitizing this. And Jim, you had been thinking, I think, if I have this right, that this would be a great subject for a movie.
Well, Nicole and I have been friends for a long time, and we had a lunch one day, and I've been her sound designer for three of her feature-length documentaries and was pitching her a bunch of ideas around disability. And I thought, there's a story here about my summer camp and these people that moved from New York out to the Bay Area, and thought that there might be this connection to a greater piece of history here.
I'm a filmmaker who loves history, and I love movement storytelling. And so I was instantly really attracted to the story when Jim told it to me, because the way he told it was infused with all the kind of humor and love and joy that I think you see in the film. And it was so exciting to think about bringing people into this kind of untold history through a lens that was, so fun and so kind of revolutionary. And then I grew up in the 70s. So for me, once we found our way to that footage, it was full of nostalgia, but also the kind of optimism of that time, that people could come together and really create a world or a future the way they wanted it to be. So it was just really kind of across time and working in collaboration with Jim and also a lot of the other people who are featured in the film that we kind of were able to kind of connect the dots and draw the line between that really profound experience of liberation in the camp and the, you know, disability rights movement that evolved throughout the 60s and 70s and eventually led us to the ADA.
There were some just amazingly engaging young future activists there, I guess, is the long and short of it.
Oh, yeah. Meeting Judy Heumann for the first time, you immediately recognize that she was this remarkable woman. And she was really my Pied Piper into the disability rights movement.
I mean, it was an optimistic time. Did you have this inkling that this could happen, or were you engaged politically as a kid?
Well, I was 15, so I, you know, barely knew what was going on around the world in general.
Right.
But I, this was absolutely eye-opening. The fact that Judy had filed a suit and prevailed to get her teaching position with the New York City Board of Education was so profoundly eye-opening to me that we could actually, like, have rights or be able to sue to get the freedoms and the rights that everybody else had. I didn't even think, cross my mind, that that was possible. So it really, and I was fired up by the time I left that camp that summer and kind of continued to be, and certainly it was something I was holding on to as I went off to college also.
Coming up after a short break, Nicole Newnham and Jim Labreck tell us about an emotional Sundance premiere. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Nicole Newnham and Jim Labreck, directors of the new documentary Crip Camp, which drops on Netflix on March 25th. It's the kind of uplifting story that's a respite in these very troubled times. Crip Camp tells the story of Camp Jened, a one-of-a-kind summer camp for disabled kids run by hippies in the early 1970s. In the film, disability rights activist and former camper Ann Capolo Freeman remembers her first summer at the upstate New York camp.
I mean, when Woodstock was happening, I remember being at my grandmother's listening on the transistor radio and saying, wish I could go, wish I could go, wish I could go. And then when I went to Jened, it was like, there I was in Woodstock. The music and the people. And just feel like, these people are crazy, you know? I mean, in a good way.
Crip Camp traces the past from the pretty grubby paradise of the camp to the front lines of activism for the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which George H.W. Bush finally signed into law in 1990. Crip Camp directors Labreck and Newnham eventually would get the backing of the former First Families production company, but when they first sought funding, they started with family.
We actually brought Jim's wife, Sarah Boulder, on board, and she's a fantastic producer. And we basically reached out initially to a lot of private individuals and foundations that we had personal connections to. And we also were supported by the Sundance Institute, who brought us to their documentary story and edit lab and gave us a grant. And then, you know, we were able to get some footage to Netflix and also to Higher Ground when they formed, and the Higher Ground principals, Priyaswami Nathan and Tonya Davis, came up and spent a bunch of time with us and looked at our footage. And so after a few hours, Priya went out and called us from the parking lot and said, you know, we're really excited to partner with you guys, and the President and Mrs. Obama feel the same way. And so that brought in the completion money that we needed to make the film, but also just this extraordinary partnership.
Did you have to be like, tell them we said hey, or do you get to meet Barack and Michelle ever in the process of this?
We think that we'll eventually wind up meeting them. There's nothing specific that we know about yet.
You're one degree of separation, so as far as I'm concerned, you know, you got to feel good.
I mean, we've spoken with him, and they did review several cuts and give us feedback and notes, which was amazing because
wow.
They have such an incredible perspective. And we continue to be so grateful that they see the importance of this story.
Oh, you're
less
than one degree of separation. You've phone met. I mean, I'm really trying to process the idea of getting notes from Barack and Michelle Obama. Do you feel like whatever they say, I'm just going to do it? Or do you feel like you can push back on the Obamas?
Well, their notes were not prescriptive. Their notes were sort of questions raised or ideas given, you know, and we definitely felt like we had creative freedom and sort of the ability to finish the film the way we wanted to. But their entire team were really fantastic collaborators.
So you ultimately make the film and you end up at Sundance, well, and won the Audience Award, which congratulations, obviously. Tell me about that experience.
We were so excited because we got to bring about 8 or 9 of the people in the film to Park City to go to Sundance with us. Mm. That was thrilling, basically, to be with that whole cohort of people who really at the time, I think, the disability community didn't get the recognition that they deserved for having fought for this civil rights law that benefits everybody. I mean, everybody who ever pushes a baby stroller up a curb ramp,
right,
you know, can thank them, you know?
Me and my bad knees thank them, definitely, yeah.
Exactly. We just came from True False, where somebody at the end of a screening said, I just have one question. Why stairs? Why? So it was super thrilling to feel like folks were going to be there and be celebrated. And we came out on stage the opening night at the Eccles Theater, which is this massive theater. And when the lights came on after the film and everybody, like 8 or 9 people from the movement were there on stage, there was this very long standing ovation. And that was a profound and beautiful moment, you know, for us to feel like that kind of recognition was finally dawning and carried over into the Audience Award, which was surreal and exciting.
I'm sure there wasn't a dry eye in the house. You got me pretty weepy there toward the end.
Sorry about that.
quite all right. It's good. It's cathartic. I need it. But I think that you were concerned. You wanted the story to be inspirational, but not in a way that felt maudlin.
Well, there's this whole kind of concept around inspiration porn when it comes to people with disabilities, where people are being praised for doing everyday things that non-disabled people think is a huge accomplishment, like putting your pants on. And
right.
But also knowing that we do want to inspire people to think about what their capabilities are in regards to being activists for what they see as in something important in this world. That certainly by example, you see that, a group of folks with disabilities could rally around and be incredibly savvy and make some incredible decisions and plans, and that they affected change that all of us enjoy today. So if you want to look at inspiration, it's not so much, gee, gol neds, you know, these handicapped people really did something here, but that, you know, change is possible and I can see how change is possible. Maybe I can do the same thing.
Jim Lebrecht and Nicole Noonan are the directors of Crip Camp. Congratulations on the film and thank you so much for coming in, notwithstanding multiple obstacles that have come in the way of our interview.
It's great to talk to you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program, and Paul Smith mixed the show. A special shout out to Paul this week, as he has made it possible for us to record safely and remotely. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.